Ruth C. Heed, Professor of Cardiology at the University of Virginia Health System. A couple of words about Dr. Beller. He got his undergraduate degree from Dartmouth College. He received his MD degree at the University of Virginia, residency at the University of Wisconsin. Cardiology fellow, he spent time both at Boston City as well as at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and then did research training in the physiology laboratory at the U.S. Army Research Institute of Environmental Medicine in Natick, Massachusetts. Became junior faculty at Harvard Medical School, and then proceeded on to become chief of the cardiovascular division at the University of Virginia Health System over more than two and a half decades there. Now, his accomplishments are many, many, too numerous to count, memberships and committees.
He's right now for non-invasive imaging, and I'm going to focus my energies in coronary artery disease and atherosclerosis. And this slide, without my reading all of these, can highlight to you the multimodality features and nature of cardiovascular imaging today, starting out with simple fluoroscopy, chest x-ray, echocardiography 25, 30 years ago. And I am going to talk a little bit about myocardial molecular imaging of plaque and also some advances in metabolic imaging at the end of my talk. Now, where we are today and just the standard clinical application of SPECT and PET related to detection of disease is summarized on this slide. And we're talking about somewhere between an 85-90% sensitivity and a specificity which for PET is higher than it is for SPECT, and we'll go into that a little bit later. The normalcy rate for SPECT, that is if you take 100 patients or 100 subjects with less than 5% likelihood of a disease, a normal exercise ECG, very atypical chest pain, approximately 9 out of 10 will have a normal scan, and that's maybe a better surrogate for specificity. Now, we have in the nuclear cardiology literature a very, very large, predominantly observational database, and this is a summary of 70,000 patients followed for an average of 2 years from 39 published series in the literature, demonstrating that if you take all patients referred for imaging, those with a normal or low-risk scan have a less than a 1% annual death or infarction rate a year, whereas those with an abnormal scan would have approximately a 7-fold increase risk of heart events per year. And this is sort of the basic prognostic standard from which other techniques are being compared, whether it be stress echo, CTA, and so forth. Now, what we want in a test that identifies low and high and intermediate and high risk patients, we would like to be able to show that when you have mild abnormalities compared to moderate and severe, that the event rates are greater. The greater the ischemic burden, the greater the combination of scar and ischemia. And note here that with pharmacologic stress, for every type of defect, the event rates are higher than with exercise. And the reason is that this patient population that cannot exercise is clinically a higher risk group. They're older, they have peripheral vascular disease, they have COPD. And this is just a classic example of Bayes analysis, where you have a higher risk, clinical risk, the prognostic value of an abnormal study is going to be greater. Now, with advances in perfusion imaging, particularly using gated SPECT and using semi-quantitation, we can identify fairly well using a 17-segment model the area of myocardium that is rendered ischemic. As shown in this patient with a proximal LAD lesion, you can see complete reversibility. And this below the images are what we call relative quantitation. This is our sort of homegrown technique, where you go from 62% of normal in the anterior wall to 89% of normal. And that difference in stress and rest counts represents 27%. That's more than two standard deviations relative to normal database, and therefore that is a significant defect. And you can see here the ischemic burden is moderate. Now, this patient is a diabetic with ischemia in all three coronary territories with reversibility, as shown here below, and also has what's called transient ischemic cavity dilation from stress to rest, which is thought to be due to subendocardial ischemia. And this is a much higher risk patient. This patient got cath and had three-vessel disease. Now, there have been attempts, and this is just one example, to move away from complex or indices that maybe are difficult for non-nuclear cardiologists to comprehend, like some stress score, some different score. We're moving more to percent of the ventricle that's ischemic using various algorithms. And this shows from the Cedars-Sinai group that for those with low EFs or higher EFs, that the cut point is about 20% of the ventricle rendered ischemic. Patients had a much lower event rate, this is non-randomized, with revascularization compared to medical therapy. And others, and patients with a normal EF and have predominantly ischemic defects, even those with just 10% or more of the ventricle rendered ischemic had a substantially lower event rate with revascularization, whereas mild ischemia, 5 to 10% of the ventricle, there was no difference. Now, this is called propensity analysis. These patient groups are matched for clinical variables, but not truly randomized. Now, we just finished a study that I think may have significant impact in understanding the role of imaging as extra cost for value. And this is going to be published in JACC. And what we did was we looked at 1 year's imaging database prospectively. And we were surprised that we had 473 patients referred to us in 1 year who were able to, for stress perfusion imaging, that were able to achieve 10 mets or more. And if we use 10% ischemia as the cutoff, as being somewhat significant where revascularization may benefit the patient, we only had one of the 473 patients had more than 10% ischemia if they reached 10 mets. And these are all with diagnostic stress tests. That is, they reached 85% or more maximum predicted heart rate. And as you got to lower workloads achieved, you got higher prevalence of ischemia. We now are doing a follow-up on all these patients, and so far we have not had, in about 2 years plus follow-up, not one cardiac death in a patient who achieved more than 10 mets of exercise. And so if you look at this and say, and I'll show you later in an algorithm, if you don't inject a tracer for someone who reaches 10 mets without ST depression, the absence of ST depression and 10 mets, not one patient had more than 10% ischemia on spec. That's 33% of all exercise tests that we did in a year. Now, if you look at this slide, this looks at a subgroup of patients with the diabetic population. It's probably now become our highest risk population, that and patients with chronic kidney disease. Now, what this shows is that diabetics with normal scans or low risk scans have an event rate that now is about 2% or more a year compared to 0.8%. This is all men and women. And an abnormal scan with a diabetic increases the event rate, type 2 diabetic, to 10% a year. And that's substantially higher event rate for the same ischemic findings than a non-diabetic. But if you look at female diabetics, this is the highest risk group of stable patients that we're now imaging. Even in a normal scan in a diabetic woman had an event rate, heart event rate, of over 3% a year. And an abnormal scan was almost 12% a year. And for some reason, and there are a lot of data coming out now, that women with metabolic syndrome and diabetes have a significantly higher risk of cardiovascular death than men when you match their ischemic burden. And that's shown here in this meta-analysis that men with an abnormal scan who had diabetes had only half the cardiac heart event rate than women in follow-up. And we won't get into whether this is gender bias, referral late, but it's an observation that has been confirmed. Now, this is some data published last year on chronic kidney disease. This is now emerging as another major risk factor to all the others that we have. And this shows you that if, when you drop your GFR, effective GFR below 60, and have significant ischemia by a high sum stress score. So if you focus on these two black bars, we're talking about a 14% event rate a year for a moderately reduced GFR or a severely reduced GFR compared to a normal GFR given the same ischemic burden. So chronic kidney disease, and we're now working with our renal group, and it's amazing how many of these patients have no angina whatsoever. And I would say that 50% or more of dialysis patients with end-stage renal disease have significant coronary disease. And actually more than 50-60% of patients with stage 3 or 4 chronic kidney disease die before they get on dialysis from cardiac disease. Now, there are limitations of SPECT for risk assessment. Attenuation artifacts and high visceral trace reactivity does affect accuracy. And probably one of the most unappreciated, but I think more appreciated limitations is that SPECT definitely underestimates extent of disease. It only measures relative flow and not absolute flow or flow reserve like PET. And now that we're seeing more and more patients with diffuse endothelial and microvascular dysfunction and metabolic syndrome, you may have a normal scan with totally abnormal flow reserve in all three coronary territories, known as balanced ischemia. Also, it doesn't detect subclinical disease and doesn't detect atherosclerosis like calcium scoring does, like CTA does. And I think that's one thing that's not appreciated about CTA. There are a lot of problems with it, but it does identify people with atherosclerosis that you might change your therapeutic strategy once you know that they have coronary disease. The technetium perfusion agents particularly plateau early with hyperemic flows. We definitely need new perfusion agents, and we haven't had any for over 20 years. And the SPECT protocols with current tracers and instrumentation are long, takes a long time. Fortunately, there are some new digital SPECT systems with fast SPECT that really cut down to 2 minutes for stress and 4 minutes for rest acquisitions. And again, we don't do absolute quantitation. Now, this is a patient with three-vessel disease, had hypertension, LVH, had three-vessel disease, and the stress and rest shows homogeneous uptake. We missed three-vessel disease in this patient, and we would have picked it up if they had ST depression or low-level angina. Now, we did a study that we published in JACC some years ago showing that among patients with angiographic three-vessel coronary disease, only 25%, that's one out of four patients with three-vessel disease, had defects or wall motion abnormalities in all three coronary territories. If you look at the first bar, this means that 88% had an abnormal scan. Reciprocal of that, 12% had a normal scan with angiographic three-vessel disease. That's 50% or more stenosis. So we are pretty good in general, but there are 1 out of 10 patients with three-vessel disease will miss, and we may be missing more, particularly in the diabetic and chronic kidney disease patients. So there are advantages of PET. Attenuation correction are more easily performed. It's intrinsic to the system. It has high spatial and contrast resolution, and it's shown, as I showed you, better specificity for PET. Now, although it's not done in most PET centers, but PET can be programmed to get absolute flow reserve. You can actually quantitate with rubidium or ammonia ml per minute per gram at rest and with stress. That's what you really is the holy grail of perfusion imaging, is to quantitate blood flow and flow reserve. Normally, flow increases fourfold with vasodilator, 4 to 5-fold. If it only increases 2-fold, that's abnormal. You may not see a scan. And most PET cameras have CT scanners now, 64-slice CT integrated, permitting multimodality and hybrid imaging. And because of the short half-lives, it permits multiple sequential acquisitions. Very soon you'll be seeing in circulation, and I was fortunate to to have reviewed this paper and wrote an editorial for it, but there's a new perfusion agent emerging that is going to be labeled with FDG that has much more favorable uptake versus flow than any of our spec tracers, maybe similar to thallium. And actually, you can do it with exercise because it's a half-life of fluorine 18. And this is a study coming out in animal models showing that a good ability to quantitate, and this new agent, which is developed by the former Bristol-Myers Squibb, is now in phase 1 and 2 testing. And this shows you again from Dr. Bateman's study that the multi-vessel disease identification, that is predicting more than one vessel in patients with three-vessel disease, was achieved in 70% of patients undergoing PET, rubidium, and only about half of the patients with SPECT. That means if a patient had three-vessel disease, you at least picked up two of the vessels, didn't mean all three. So where we are now, I think, in an algorithm sense, in our conventional imaging, is that we image patients primarily who have intermediate likelihood of disease for ischemia. Now, if you're doing stress testing alone and they're low risk and they have no ischemia or minimal, or they reach 10 mets and no ST depression, then optimal medical therapy is the first kind of approach and crossover for symptoms. Patients with high risk non-invasive tests, and we don't know what the threshold is, but 10%, 12%, 7.5, it varies, of ischemia or multivessel disease pattern, transient ischemic dilation, an invasive strategy seems to offer a better prognosis and outcome than initial medical therapy. Even the COURAGE substudy trial showed that for high-risk perfusion imaging scans, the patients had a lower event rate and you reduced ischemia more with PCI plus optimum medical therapy. It wasn't powered for events. And this is the group of patients who have mild ischemia, non-diabetics, no multivessel disease, that perhaps, as in the COURAGE trial, you start with optimum medical therapy and then cross over, because these were the patients primarily in the COURAGE trial that sort of not high-risk disease. Now, CTA is now emerging as a complementary or alternative non-invasive way of detecting coronary disease in symptomatic patients, not a screening test. And this is just a slide to introduce me into this field. Now, there's one study, and there have been several others that have looked at this, and that deals with how does non-invasive CTA with dual source or 64-slice CT estimate of stenosis severity correlate with quantitative angiography and invasive procedure. And what you see here is that there tends to be an overestimation of diameter stenosis by 64-slice CT, it's above the line, relative to the diameter stenosis that is adjudicated by quantitative angiography. And what this does, if you maximize your ROC curve for sensitivity, as done in this study, in Matt's big study, the accuracy trial, you can get a high sensitivity, but your positive predictive value is limited. Is 64% because many stenoses that you identify as being 50%, 60, or 70 are really not that significant. But as excellent negative predictive value when you do your ROC curve maximizing detection rate. That is pristine, normal CTA, pretty good a bet that the coronary angiogram will be normal. And this is on the vessel sensitivity, and you can see here the positive predictive value is quite low. Now, if you look at another multicenter study that came out just about the same time that was not maximized to sensitivity, was more for specificity, now you see a lesser sensitivity, higher specificity, a better positive predictive value, but a lower negative predictive value. And this is just classic kind of findings that you do depending on where you put your threshold. But most studies have shown good negative predictive value but not positive predictive value. Now, this is a paper of a nice review of the positive and negative predictive value of CTA for predicting ischemia. So we're going to shift gears. The previous slides was predicting stenosis severity relative to angiography. And what I concluded was that for the most part, intermediate stenoses on CTA are not as severe when you look at CAF, overestimated. Blooming effect from calcium, other reasons. Now, this is an analysis of four recent studies looking at how it predicts ischemia or no ischemia. Again, negative predictive value when you do multimodality imaging in the same patient is pretty good. But look at the positive predictive value for predicting ischemia. That is, when you judge patients who have 50% or more stenosis on CTA, and that you call significant, only half will have ischemia by PET or SPECT. And so far we know from data from the planar imaging days from the 1980s, it's ischemia that really predicts prognosis, not so much just anatomy alone, but it's the ischemic burden. And so this is one of the limitations. But on the positive side, I think there's one thing that has not been appreciated, and this is what you would expect for greater obstructive vessel disease on CTA and prognosis, that the greater the number of significant stenoses, the number of vessels with stenoses, the worse the outcome. But this group of patients up here with non-obstructive vessel disease are missed totally on a functional test. And you can see here that if you have three vessels that have subclinical stenoses that would have no ischemia, you do have a worse event rate than if you have completely normal study. So what CTA does is not only pick up significant stenoses, which are overestimated, but it will pick up atherosclerosis. And now there's some nice algorithms that are being tested to do plaque characterization. We're using Hounsfield units or density where you can even hopefully identify plaques that have predominantly lipid compared to fibrous tissue. Now, here's an example of multimodality imaging where you have calcium in the vessel, some intermediate or minor stenoses, but the perfusion imaging is normal. This means the patient has atherosclerosis, but not ischemia. Here's another patient where the CTA shows lots of calcium, shows a non-critical plaques all over the vessel, and you can see here that this is a significant ischemic burden here by IVUS that confirms that, but the perfusion imaging is normal. Now, this isn't balanced ischemia. This is the fact that there's no ischemia-producing lesions, but there's significant diffuse atherosclerosis. You might like to know that in some way in a patient, with risk factors that you might lower the LDL to below 70 in this patient rather than below 130 if you knew that there was atherosclerosis. Now, some patients where you have great concordancy, this is a CTA showing multiple lesions, critical, non-critical, and here the SPECT shows significant LAD apical reversibility. So there is concordance. Now, here's an example where PET imaging was used like SPECT, like most PET imaging is used, and that is looking at just relative perfusion. Okay, so you're looking at the anterior wall versus the inferior septum versus the post. This is a normal PET, but this patient has a totally occluded left main coronary artery on CTA. So this is a patient with balanced ischemia and has diffuse coronary disease, and right coronary disease must have been present as well. And how many of these patients have this type of high-risk disease on CTA with a normal perfusion scan? It's about 4%. 4 of 100 have severe left main or three vessel disease, but any obstructive disease, 20% will have a normal scan. But with non-obstructive disease, And with no CAD, you could see the percentage of patients that have abnormal multi-slice CT. And these are all these patients have normal scans. So what an anatomic-based non-invasive test does is it picks up a lot of these patients that you would not expect to have ischemia. These patients. One-third of the patients have non-obstructive disease. You make a diagnosis of atherosclerosis. Now, this is what's called fusion imaging. And there's been a recent study that was just published last month showing that the combination of the two that are fused and superimposed by registration provides a higher detection rate of high-risk disease than either test alone. Now, here's an example. This is a patient on CTA, has a significant diagonal lesion, and has some LAD disease. And this is a volumetric display of perfusion, where highest perfusion is in yellow, and as you go down into the blue, that's significant hypoperfusion on the perfusion scan. Now, this diagonal stenosis is associated with a very large area of risk of ischemic burden. So you can imagine looking at all of the coronary anatomical findings and being able to quantitate perfusion, and you really will be able to get all the information that is needed for prognostication and treatment. Now, if you combine the two, and I'll tell you the downside of that in a minute, if you have a normal CT scan and a normal myocardial perfusion scan, no events in that population, none. If you have an abnormal CT, but a normal perfusion scan, 6% event rate, and if you combine and have abnormal anatomy associated with abnormal perfusion, the event rate jumped up to 27%. So what's the value of this integral approach? Most of this information is from PET CT. Well, you get a correct diagnosis in all patients. And CTA detects non-critical plaques, and you do a calcium score, which is important for overall prognosis. CTA has excellent sensitivity for proximal and mid-vessel stenoses, but perfusion imaging is not affected by the location of the stenosis. You can have severe distal disease that you can't see on CTA, but you'll have abnormal perfusion. And you eliminate the underestimation of multivessel disease seen with perfusion imaging alone. You will not miss balanced ischemia. But what is the problem with this? It's cost and it's radiation burden for performing both tests in each patient. Otherwise, why wouldn't you do it? If you have the same instrument, it's cost and radiation. If we could get the cost down, radiation down, and select the patients, not the lowest risk patients and not the high risk patients that should go directly to cath, it may be cost effective and it may save lives. I don't know, this never been looked at prospectively. Now, if you really want to look at multimodality imaging, this is an example of what of the future. This is CMR fused with PET, and the PET fusion is both with blood flow and metabolism, showing that this infarct that has hyper-enhancement and what looks like a substantial amount of scar and has reduced blood flow has a hot spot of glucose uptake. So there's a lot of viable myocardium. And what you see here volumetrically, this is the volume of the apex that's hypoperfused, and this is the hot spot of viability. So here's an example of looking at the same time an MR scan with a PET scan and looking at PET as blood flow and viability, and the MR, you're looking at scar, you could look at function. Very interesting. So the question is, can we improve the entire scenario of non-invasive imaging, looking at rest and stress, using a dynamic imaging procedure that will provide more information than just the relative perfusion that we're doing now? And I want to share with you some really nice approach. Well, first of all, there is a way to do this. You put regions of interest on the myocardium. You inject the tracer, you get dynamic images, you get blood pool images, you correct for attenuation, for decay, for spillover, and then you can actually come up with an absolute blood flow determination non-invasively. And this is one of the first examples of this, where if you look at the bullseye plot in this patient with three vessel disease, what you picked up is merely an inferior defect. Now, when you quantitated the absolute flow, and that's shown here, from this looks like from 1.8 ml to down to 0.16, what you find is that at stress, the blood flow never got above like about 0.3 ml per minute above rest. So now you made a diagnosis by not looking at relative perfusion, but everything is blacked out and has shown diffuse three-vessel ischemia. And this is stress minus rest, showing that there was absolute no flow increase, very little in all these three vessels. Now, this is a more sophisticated volumetric way. In a 67-year-old male, 3 months stable exercise angina that got more severe. So he had some severe chest pain. Exercise capacity were normal, but he had his test showed severe chest pain and ST depression. So this is the CTA and adenosine perfusion for oxygen 15 water, another tracer that measures blood flow. Now you can see here that this looks red is normal flow, and down here blue is abnormal. And you can see here that there is a mild defect here in the sort of LAD territory relative to the circumflex territory. Now, when you actually quantitated flow using dynamic PET, what you see here is that the flow with adenosine never got over 1.3. And now you made a diagnosis, the blood, an ml per minute per gram of three-vessel disease, and this patient at cath had left main stenosis, distal LAD, calcified plaques, RCA. This is the CTA, showing multiple stenoses. And in this prospective study, dynamic PET in 106 patients, intermediate likelihood, who had PET perfusion with oxygen 15 water, they had invasive angiography with FFR, and they compared the way we ordinarily do SPECT imaging or PET, looking at relative perfusion versus absolute flow from 0 to 3.5 ml per minute. And for absolute perfusion, for detection of disease, very high accuracy, but look at this for multivessel disease, 94% positive predictive value, 96% negative predictive value for quantitative PET for identifying multivessel disease, only 33% positive predictive value from looking at just relative perfusion from one area to the next. So that is the difference between getting a display like this where you quantitate flow and show it in a color that the flow never rose above 1.3 in all three coronary territories, relative to just relative flow, where you're just comparing one area to the other, and you don't really know the absolute change, you totally underestimated extent of disease. So let me just shift gears to another area of multimodality imaging, and that deals with calcium scoring. There's a lot of interest in identifying the calcification and atherosclerotic arteries that are part of the healing process and part of the evolution of vulnerable plaques to stable plaques. And what you see here is no coronary calcium, mild calcification, and severe calcification in two major coronary arteries. And there have been several studies that have shown in asymptomatic population, we're shifting gears now to asymptomatic patients, that the higher the calcium score, especially over 400 or over 1,000, the worse the event-free survival in these 10,000 patients over 5 years. So the greater the atherosclerotic burden in an asymptomatic screen population, the worse the event rate. Up until now, I was talking mostly about symptomatic patients looking at ischemia or coronary anatomy. Now, this study, which was just presented, it's a German multi-center trial, was presented at the late-breaking trials of the ACC, showing in a large number, almost 30% of these patients that are totally asymptomatic, showing that a calcium score of 400 or more had a significant increase in cardiac event rate in patients compared to patients with less than 100. And in the high-risk clinical subgroup by ATP3, there also was an ability to risk stratify. But the key feature of this study presented by Dr. Erbel in 20,000 patients, that over a period of 5 years, that calcium scoring in an intermediate risk group definitely were able to re-stratify the patients, where this group now becomes very high risk and now gets LDL cholesterol targeted under 70, gets more aggressive therapy. Again, totally asymptomatic. This shows that the greater the calcium score, the higher the prevalence of silent ischemia. And in this study from the Brigham, the frequency of PET ischemia was about 47% in patients with calcium scores of over 400 and calcium scores of over 1,050. But even people with low calcium scores, some still had ischemia due to soft plaque. Now, what is interesting to me is that the diabetics, compared to patients without diabetes who have zero calcium scores, have a very good prognosis. In contrast, the diabetics in this study from England, once you get the calcium score of over 400, the risk of death or MI goes up 40-fold. In this type 2 asymptomatic diabetic population, followed for 2 years, 500 patients, those with a calcium score of over 1,000 had a 58-fold increase of events. Whereas those with a 0 to 100 calcium score, the asymptomatic type 2 diabetics, had no events. So in this population, it's very interesting that the diabetics were able to be risk stratified quite well. And this is that same study from London showing that the calcium score of over 400 and over 1,000, you can see here that a large number of these patients, 48% had ischemia, but half of the ischemia was large reversible defects of more than 10%. And over a calcium score of over 1,000, substantial amount of moderate and severe ischemia. That is 7 out of the 10 asymptomatic type 2 diabetics with calcium scores of over 1,000 had ischemia on imaging and multimodality imaging. Whereas those with zero calcium scores or less than 10 had no ischemia. And those with ischemia, as you can see here, the ischemic burden of just more than 5% of the ventricle in this type 2 diabetic population had a worse event-free survival than patients with 1 to 5% ischemia and 0% ischemia. And the coronary calcium score by ROC curve added significant prognostic information over the Framingham risk score or the UKPDS, which is a specific risk score for diabetics. So this shows in this group study that calcium imaging in the type 2 diabetics was improved risk assessment for higher risk patients than just a clinical score alone. And in The Lancet, just about 3 or 4 months ago, about maybe 4 or 5 months ago, published a PREDICT trial in type 2 diabetics, asymptomatic, no history of cardiovascular disease at all, cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI, unstable angina, and objective evidence of CAD or stroke was the endpoint. And you could see here, as you went in an adjusted model or unadjusted, in these type 2 diabetics, the prediction of events, the hazard ratio was significantly increased the higher the calcium score. And this may be better displayed on my next slide here, where it shows you, again, diabetics with low calcium scores in a short term have very few events. But once you reach the threshold in this study of 100 and over 400 and over 1,000, the cumulative combined event rate, stroke, MI, death, and so forth, significantly increased. And this was a very well done prospective study. So just for hypothesis testing, I would suggest we need to do a study where we do conventional clinical risk assessment, and those at intermediate or high risk who are diabetics based on other risk factors and metabolic syndrome, maybe we do a CT calcium score first, do myocardial perfusion imaging for high calcium scores, and depending on the perfusion imaging finding, either go to invasive angiography or aggressive risk assessment. Whereas a low-risk diabetic without metabolic syndrome, without multiple other risk factors, maybe just treat according to guidelines. So this is an interesting subgroup of patients where I think it'll come out that calcium scoring may add some increased risk benefit to tailoring therapy and even doing stress imaging for picking up silent ischemia. So I'd like to just finish up on some new areas, and that is fatty acid and glucose metabolism, but not for viability, but for ischemia. We know that under aerobic fasting conditions, the heart primarily uses fatty acid. And during ischemia, there's switches to glucose utilization, which supplies ATP through anaerobic glycolysis. So there's decreased fatty acid utilization and enhanced glucose. It's the metabolic signature of the ischemic heart. Now, BMI-BP is a fatty acid which shows prolonged reduced uptake after transient ischemia, even when coronary blood flow is returned to normal. Whereas FDG glucose, and this is, should be I-123, which is what's being used now, shows enhanced uptake, which is the reciprocal of the decreased fatty acid uptake. Now, we're used to seeing this mismatch pattern of glucose on viability imaging by PET, where you have decreased myocardial blood flow with preserved glucose uptake. This is the classic mismatch pattern for viability, telling you that there is hypoperfusion, but there's viability. Now, this is a very intriguing study. I don't think many of you know about this. There was another paper, I think, published in Circulation. And what the authors did here is they did rest and exercise SPECT, and then they followed it by FDG. And here you can see in the antroceptal defect, here's stress, exercise, and here's rest that shows reversibility, and here's glucose uptake, showing that it fits just like a puzzle into the septum, that post-ischemic anaerobic metabolism just with exercise stress. And here is the same thing in the antroapical area. You could see the hot spot of glucose uptake that will fit right into the exercise and rest defect. Now, here's a patient with three-vessel disease and balanced ischemia. That is, there are no defects here, really, that you could clearly state from exercise to rest. They injected glucose in this patient, and what you see here in the FDG is that the entire ventricle on all these views, vertical long axis, is now anaerobically metabolizing post-exercise. Isn't that something? Three-vessel balanced ischemia that was only picked up by the reversal from fatty acid uptake to glucose uptake. And when they did this, they found, if you look down here, that when they looked at the FDG, fluorine 18, the identification of numbers of vascular territories increased for ischemic territories from perfusion from 31% to 67% by having multimodality imaging of combination of blood flow and metabolism with exercise stress. Now, the same thing can be done with fatty acid. This is BMI-BP. It's a long-chain fatty acid, but it doesn't readily undergo beta oxidation. So the potential to detect and localize disturbed fatty acid metabolism is significant. So this BMI-BP, this is the name for it, I won't read it out loud, it's a methyl branch chain fatty acid, and it gets trapped in the heart when the heart extracts fatty acid. And defects in uptake of this tracer reflects the decreased fatty acid metabolism. And following an ischemic event, there's a prolonged ischemic period of disturbed fatty acid metabolism, even when blood flow returns to normal. And even 30 hours after a single ischemic episode, there can still be decreased fatty acid uptake. Here is a situation that from the Japanese literature that really started working on this, where the thallium was normal, I think was, 8 hours or something after an ischemic episode, but the BMI-BP still showed abnormal uptake. And here's an example of abnormal BMI-BP uptake in a patient with unstable angina with one episode of pain. And here's a very nice study showing exercise-induced ischemia by thallium with reversibility. And then this is BMI-BP, and this is 22 hours post-exercise. They injected it, and here is still a defect compared to normal BMI-BP in that inferior wall that was ischemic a day before. And this is what is called ischemic memory imaging, where if someone comes to the emergency room and had their pain 2 hours before, and the EKG is normal, you can still pick up by a memory of the ischemic event. And if you look at the outcome of patients with BMI-BPs negative versus positive in patients with angina, the difference between the low-risk group and the high-risk group is the same as stress thallium. And in fact, the sensitivity in 5 studies in the literature for detecting coronary disease and unstable angina was 86%. With BMI-BP and 95% specificity. And here's an example of a 48-year-old man with symptoms suspicious of an ACS. He had 30 minutes of chest pain, no prior coronary disease, no ECG changes, troponin was negative. So he was thought to be intermediate likelihood for an ACS. All troponins were negative. The BMI-BP was injected 8 hours after the symptoms subsided, and then you could see here the BMI-BP defect is seen at rest, and here's the bullseye plot. They did a follow-up SPECT with exercise, and they found a reversible lateral wall defect. So here's a patient, no troponin, no ECG, previous remote chest pain, who has a significant defect that reflects ischemic memory. So BMI-BP imaging, and there's a multi-center trial in which we participated in the emergency room. It's completed but not yet published, where we injected this tracer with acute chest pain patients that even many hours after cessation of symptoms can detect or rule out an ACS or an MI in the emergency room. The ability to image prolonged post-ischemic abnormalities in fatty acid metabolism or ischemic memory, allowing imaging long after symptoms subside, is really unique in this setting. And these data support the performance of larger pivotal trials that are now ongoing in this population. So this is, again, the reversal of the glucose picture. And my final few slides is the real future. I've shown you that we can image physiology, perfusion, with stress echo function, with MRI, perfusion function, CT, anatomy, MRI anatomy, function, all of it. But, and I've shown you we can image metabolism, PET, SPECT. But where we really would like to move the research field is to imaging plaques, imaging vulnerable plaques. identify the metabolic activity of macrophages or other inflammatory cells in vulnerable plaques can be done with using the same tracer I showed you that measures glucose utilization in the heart. And we can localize FDG can localize in atheromas in the carotid, aortic, and CAD lesions. So here is the type of lesion you would like to identify: a thin fibrous cap, a lipid core with lots of oxidized LDL, foam cells, and macrophages. Can we do this? It's been shown that this area even has increased temperature when they were doing that invasive with the thermal, you know, tip catheters, because it's an inflammatory lesion. And here's one of the first examples in a carotid vulnerable plaque, a hot spot of FDG in the plaque. Here's the CTA, and here's the fusion image, where you can see that that linear area of hot uptake of inflammation is superimposed right on the coronary carotid stenosis. And here is an FDG PET. Here is the plaque shown on CT, and here it is in higher view. You see that area? That's the plaque. And here's the fusion image of the FDG PET, and it shows that this plaque is a vulnerable plaque. It's filled with macrophages and a lipid core. And if you actually follow these types of patients and look at FDG in plaques or in animal models, the actual FDG uptake goes down when you give a statin. And this is one of the first examples of how you can monitor the inflammatory activity of a plaque non-invasively. And that's what this shows. Compared to diet alone, the reduction in FDG activity in the plaque in this JACC article was shown. And here's an example of diet post-treatment. It didn't do anything to vulnerable plaques in both the aortic arch here and in both carotid arteries. But with PET imaging and simvastatin, you can see a substantial decrease. And here's a vulnerable plaque that lights up with FDG in a hot spot here on this fusion image that now disappears. That the plaque has been converted from a vulnerable plaque or an inflammatory plaque to a plaque that no longer shows hypermetabolic activity. And here is one of the first examples of being able to image FDG in the coronary artery. And here you can see the invasive angiogram, and here you can see the hot spot in the coronary artery. And the problem with this mainly is resolution. The heart is moving, but we're working, several groups are working now. We're working on an oxidized, on a radio-labeled antibody to oxidized LDL. Other people are using probes for MMP. So there are at least five different imaging agents that are being used to try to identify those vulnerable plaques. And here you could see a bunch in the aorta. Here's one of FDG in the left main coronary artery. This is a patient with left main hypermetabolic activity. And this is for the future. This is FDG PET combined multimodality imaging. So to conclude my Wiggers lecture today, conventional stress rest perfusion imaging with spectro PET does provide clinically useful diagnostic and prognostic information. I showed you that patients with low risk scans have a lower event rate. They're a cutoff for ischemia. PET has better sensitivity and specificity, better rate of detection of multivessel disease than SPECT, and SPECT underestimates the severity of disease. But the way PET imaging needs to move is to image absolute blood flow. This will enhance the non-invasive detection of multivessel disease, and I think will identify more higher risk patients than what we're doing now with conventional relative perfusion imaging. CTA has excellent negative predictive value, but it's suboptimal positive predictive value for detecting stenoses of 50% or more. SPECT CT or PET CT combined Multimodality and fusion imaging can assist in determining the functional significance of CAD seen on CTA. It can make the CTA stenosis, it can tell you whether it's functionally significant or not, or it can detect high-risk anatomy in patients who have normal perfusion scans or low-risk scans. So you get a lot of information. Even CT calcium imaging in asymptomatic patients, I think, and I would not advocate this, it's not approved by FDA, but I think it's intriguing that in this diabetic population, that you would expect a lot of these diabetics to have soft plaques and rupture, but if they have a zero calcium score, at least for the short term, they seem to have a good prognosis. But calcium scores in a type 2 diabetic of over 400 have substantially high event rate and also a high prevalence of silent ischemia. And metabolic imaging showed you some new data on how you might multimodality image with metabolism with perfusion, not just anatomy and perfusion, may even enhance more the detection of multivessel disease and detect prior ischemic episodes in unstable coronary syndromes. And finally, one area of great interest among researchers in radionuclide imaging and MRI, CT, is molecular imaging. And molecular imaging of plaques, of vessels, and also molecular imaging of stem cells, of other metabolic activity. And I just want to tell you, I just reviewed a paper, very interesting for circulation, that they looked at PET scans of patients who were screened for cancer, for metastatic lesion. And they identified over 100 patients that had a lot of FDG in their aorta as they were doing abdominal PET. And these patients survived their cancer. They didn't have cancer. And what they did was they followed these patients up, and believe it or not, the greater the number of FDG plaques in the aorta was the higher the cardiovascular mortality and follow-up. So this is a systemic disease, and even imaging the aorta or carotids looking for multiple vulnerable plaques could identify the vulnerable patient that you might not even have to necessarily image the plaques in the coronary artery. And I think this is where the field is moving. And how this will all pan out with practice guidelines, with cost effectiveness. We almost have too many tools in imaging now, and yet we have almost no randomized studies to determine their worth. But I'm optimistic that we'll do the right thing, we'll do some comparative effectiveness research, and try to help our patients by using this technology the best way possible. Thanks for your attention. Right. I hope I can answer your question right. One of the hopes of this new imaging technology, particularly the functional imaging, metabolic imaging or molecular imaging, that it could be used to test new drugs and new interventions, where you would not need to right away go to very expensive multi-center trials. So let's say a drug company or a lab developed a new drug that decreased inflammation in the coronary arteries, as opposed to just aspirin and statins, which we have now. Let's say it was directed at oxidized LDL, which there is a drug being tested now. Well, to my mind, proof of principle of such an intervention, of all these new ideas, could be determined by these techniques. That is, I showed you that just simvastatin reduced the actual plaque inflammation. So if we get different molecular probes for apoptosis of the plaque, for MMP, imaging with MRI, the fibrous, if we could then look at any types of interventions that we want to do, pharmacologic or otherwise, and then validate that at the cath lab with OCT or IVUS, I think these imaging techniques might save money in investigation of new drugs. Now, we always have to be careful about surrogate endpoints, but it's an idea. Now, where we are heading in this there's no way the FDA and Medicare are going to approve new imaging technologies just because they have a good sensitivity or specificity. I don't know if Steve Nissen is still here, but Steve has been writing about this. And I know Dr. Thomas has been interested in this. They want to show that a new imaging technique affects decision-making and then reduces risk and saves lives. And this is where the research has to go. Jim, I don't know if you want to mention anything, because you've been very interested in this. I appreciate your comments about this whole area of new technology, multimodality technology, which we're training our fellows to do. How is this going to get approved when it's cost, unless we show cost effectiveness? You know, I would even go a step further. We may have actually gone too far in using advanced imaging tests in low-risk patients. I don't know about your lab, but I've done a canvas and I've seen a couple of abstracts presented. You know what percentage of patients in our nuclear lab have normal scans? Say we do 10 patients, 7 are going to be normal, 6 are normal with Yes, same thing. That's what I hear. Tony DiMaria tells me the same. A lot of people tell me that every year for the last decade, the numbers of normal studies getting higher. And that's because a lot of primary care physicians, a little bit of chest pain in the emergency, people are getting a test. And I think the study that we are, you know, fortunately are going to be able to have published in JACC showed that the stress ECG in a low-risk population of patients who can still achieve more than 10 mets, and you know, if you can go 10, 15 mets, you can't have three-vessel disease, had almost no ischemia. And so only 4% had any ischemia. So we have to even go back and say, if we're going to use the expensive tests and have CMS pay more for that, we have to make sure we use them in the right patient population. And in that population, the intermediate risk population to high risk, then compare multiple tests. But we have a lot of low-risk patients that we know, even by interviewing them, don't have coronary disease. Right, right. You know that.
The hard thing is to get people to stop ordering those. And the place where I see it are like pre-op testing.
to repeat your question, patients who have an abnormal perfusion scan but a non-critical lesions on CTA, we're seeing that more and more now. You know what group? There was a paper published just about a couple months ago showing that in patients with chronic kidney disease who have non-critical coronary stenoses but perfusion defects have a very high event rate. And I think what it is that they have tremendous extensive endothelial and microvascular dysfunction. So the ischemia you're picking up may not be due to any specific, you know, lesion. And the coronary CTA didn't underestimate it, and the scan was not a false positive. It's truly ischemia, but it's due to a different mechanism. It's due to microvascular flow reserve abnormality. Syndrome X patients have abnormal microvascular function. So I think that we used to write these people off and say these were false positive functional tests. But in reality, some of them were not. Some of them truly were abnormal flow reserve, but due to a different mechanism than a 90% stenosis.
Dr. Beller, it's my privilege to present you with a plaque that says the Ohio chapter of the American College of Cardiology recognizes George A. Beller, MD, MACC, as the 2009 Carl J. Wiggers Memorial Lecturer.
Thank you.
Thank you for a terrific talk.
Thank you very much.